This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. Cool. So this is the starting of an episode. And this is how it starts. We don't know the number. We don't know if it is our last one together, but we are excited nonetheless, and we're going to pick up right where we left off in our conversation.
Awesome. So we have Eric and Ron joining us. If you haven't heard the totality of this story so far, we highly suggest you starting with episode 44 so you can hear all the pieces. Eric is the former CEO of Era Energy, and Ron is the former EHS manager for Era Energy. And they are sharing with us their story of adopting HOP concepts and what that looked like from the organization, from their two very distinct and really helpful vantage points for us to understand the thought process involved, the steps involved, the trials and tribulations, the parts that were scary, the parts that seemed easy, so that hopefully as others are trying to go down this path that they have something to hold on to, right? Something that they've seen before, a model that they have at least heard before to understand how a change like this is made. And where we left off last episode, I think, was it a really important aspect of any sort of transformational change in an organization. And Eric had spoken to the fact that in shifting the direction of safety, this wasn't the first time that he's had to shift something, right, within an organization, and that there's aspects of transformation that seem pretty common independent of what you're trying to, what path you're trying to go down within an organization. Part of that, a really influential and important part of that, are the incentives, the rewards, the metrics that people are subject to, which ultimately ties back to what good looks like, a definition of what good looks like. And why we thought it was so critical for us to have conversation around this is I think that in some cases, myself included, absolutely, I've done a disservice to this movement in terms of de-emphasizing the importance of a KPI. And part of the reason that happens is because in many organizations, when we're trying to originally make this shift, there isn't an Eric that's ready. There isn't somebody on the C-suite who has the ability to go influence a board to change a metric. And so people are trying to make a change in spite of measurements that are not aligned with what they're doing. Because we've had so much conversation around that, I think that it inadvertently reduces the messaging on the importance of being able to align the incentive. And what Eric mentioned, and I think is really important message, is that was a key aspect of the foundational change. Like without it, is it fair to say that without changing that, Eric, you don't think that you would have seen a shift in what people were doing ultimately?
Yeah,
how would you measure that?
On the margin. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it'd be more on the margin. I think it's fundamental because incentives do signal what the priority is.
Yeah.
And therefore, yeah, I think drive behavior. So, you know, all credit to the board for coming along on that journey and acknowledging that the best way we can measure success is by looking at the potential significant injuries that where we failed lucky versus failing safely. That was a huge shift, which was, I think, fundamental to the initial launch of this concept into the organization.
Yeah. And I think what is incredibly beneficial for the folks that are able to listen to this, what brings, in my mind, some amount of a real context to what it means to change this metric, is the fact that you do have not only your vantage point, Eric, of what the metric change was, right, and what it was like to have to go through the conversation with the board to try to change it and then communicate that out, but then from Ron's perspective, we have what that actually did. Meaning, while you're sitting in a place where the day-to-day details of what people are doing to help drive that metric, those details can be pretty far from your vantage point, Eric, from where you are. Ron's in the middle of the mess of being able to see what actually happens when that metric was changed. And Ron, are you willing to tell us kind of some of the from your point of view, the early communications, the change in the metric and what you saw, like what happened when it was changed?
Sure, absolutely. I think I remember, you know, following that kind of initial conversation that Eric and I had, you know, Eric sort of introduced himself at an employee call. And one of the first, you know, communication exchanges that he had with the entire organization in an employee call was specifically around this topic. And I remember, and I'm sure most other leaders and employees remember it as well. You know, he shared the personal story that I think we talked about in episode 44 and sort of why he cares so much about safety and our environmental health and safety performance. And he specifically talked about the number one principle here that you know, humans make mistakes. And saying it out loud in front of the whole organization that we, in order to get better, have to accept and embrace that as a fact. And in order to move forward, we needed to build systems that accommodate for those mistakes and introduce the concept of failing safe in a loud and very obvious and well-articulated way. And then subsequently, in follow-up all employee calls, other leaders began to talk about this concept in a similar kind of way.
Now, Eric, just out of curiosity, Eric, was that a thing that you asked other leaders to do? So after setting this communication, were you like, this is what we're going to communicate out for our next all employee meeting for a period of time?
Yeah. I mean, this was really a triad of myself, the safety leadership, and the operations leadership. If the three of us had any daylight between what one of us was saying and what the others were saying, the organization is going to pick that up instantly, and you're going to lack credibility. And going back to what it takes to enact change, if employees don't see leadership role modeling the change, and leadership isn't just the CEO or the COO, it's the senior leaders that they touch. If they're not seeing that kind of uniformity and conviction and belief, yeah, it just creates cracks. And people start to really question, is this just a fad? Is it going to go away? Or do I need to pay attention because this is real? And I got to tell you that I remember that employee call very clearly that Ron's talking about. And I got to be honest with you, I was a little bit frightened about it. I didn't know how people would receive a message that said, we are going to focus on life-changing potential. We're going to focus on life-changing jobs that occur in the field, and we're going to de-emphasize in what we're focusing on and rewarding the recordables. I thought that it would result in, when I go out to the field, to people really kind of being like, so does that mean you don't care anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Which is like 100% the opposite of
what's what you're trying to achieve. Yeah.
Is a deep care that we don't have lives change. But I worried that people would see this as, okay, well, you're just raising the bar to focus on something that's, quote, easier or less frequent to make your numbers look better, right? In a very cynical way. And also potentially conclude that I didn't care about cuts or bruises. And I do, broken bones. But I got to tell you, I mean, so I was worried about that, how it would be received. And that people would not take away the wrong message.
And going to Ron, how was it received, right? So Eric has an intent of what he's trying to communicate, then subsequently other operational leadership are echoing the same thing. The fear that Eric has is not an uncommon fear. And I remember, I think talking about it with you, Eric, you know, previous to that communication of that fear. Ron, do you remember how it was received? I'm sure it wasn't a blanket reception of everybody thinking the same thing or thinking all cynically or all positively, or I mean, maybe you can only speak from how it struck you.
I think I have a pretty good feel for how the entirety of, I mean, not everyone, but most folks received it. And I think it was, you know, the reaction was, thank goodness. Like, we're really tired of working on stuff, you know, that probably is not going to make much of a difference. You know, we really don't want to spend all this time on the trip in the parking lot, you know, event with the bruised knee that resulted in 3 stitches. You know, let's fix it and move on and make sure that the worker gets the care that they need. And that was very well received within the organization. We work in a high risk industry, and mm-hmm. we want our resources to be dedicated to those things that can really hurt people. And so I think that message resonated, you know, top to bottom. You know, I think people were aligned and on board and ready to move. And once the metrics aligned with that belief system, you know, we had a lot of support moving forward. And I might even, and I don't know if it's too early, but this was like the great leadership moment from my perspective that I saw that was just incredible. And if, you know, for those CEOs or health and safety professionals that might be listening to this, that might send this podcast to their CEOs, I would like every CEO in America to hear this, because I think it's important. But what Eric did in this same time frame was he said to the line organization and the leaders that he expected them, not the EHS organization, to know what their high consequence activities that they have occurring during the day, know where they're happening, understand what the critical barriers are and the health of them, and act to strengthen them. That was the expectation that he said for the line organization. And Eric, I'm paraphrasing, so add as you see fit, but I want you to know the next day we had on our doorstep an entire line organization pulling us into their business, begging us for support and help. It was not a rope that we needed to push. It was definitely something that we were getting, I'll say, drug into, and we could not work hard enough or fast enough to deliver the service that we were built to provide. So I just, like, I've pushed a lot of initiatives over the goal line, and that felt dramatically different because of the leadership that Eric displayed in that moment. And I think as a result, you know, created an avenue for us all to be successful.
So this is a big statement, Ron, and I agree with it. But I want to reiterate how important this sounds, and then we'll let Eric use his very own words to describe it, right? So your hope is that every CEO, you said in America, I'm going to say the world. So every CEO that has the potential to hear this, that this is the thing that they know. And this thing that they know that Eric did, what did you tell folks, Eric? What did you want them to be able to know about their operations?
Yeah, I just want to say that this isn't something special that I did that other people can't do. It's I think it is repeatable. It really comes down to conviction and the belief that we're imperfect And that if we're going to make progress on safety, we have to recognize that imperfection, build systems that are robust to it so that people don't go home with a life-changing injury. That's one, is that conviction. Number two is aligning the board and the metrics to create that full circle of, of incentive and action in the organization. And, you know, Ron was compressing things a little bit. We did the town hall, but I also went out to the field and talked to operations leaders. I talked to people working at the coalface in the field with wrenches in their hand, and I wanted honest feedback. And I knew we were onto something when I heard almost uniformly something along the lines of, yes, this sounds right. And I won't say it was uniform. I will pause and say that in these town halls, I have anonymous questions, Q&As that come in on the screen. And there was a question of, well, you don't care about this anymore. You don't care about the cuts. I did get the question, but that was the opening for me as the leader to reiterate the why. The why isn't because I don't care about cuts or bruises or broken bones. The why is because we have limited resources in the organization time in the day. What we need to focus on most is that we don't have life-changing injuries, families going through grief and loss. Somebody's life changed forever because they chose to come to work on our asset. That is a tough ask, but I think that this shift can help move us in that direction. So I knew we were onto something when I went to the field and tested, and people were willing to go along with this conceptually and get past the knee jerk that, hey, this means you don't care about X, right? So from that, and this is Ron's point about the pull in the organization, what do you do once you've changed the top level metric and you have aligned people on the idea that, hey, we want to go in this direction for the right reason? What do you do behind that? And that was the key thing. So it was right around business planning time. Like right now we're sitting in December as we record this. So maybe a couple months before you're talking about the year that's coming up. And I remember we got together all of the top leaders in the organization and the next level down. And what I told them was, hey, what this means. And the COO at the time was brilliant about this, is that fundamentally we want to know we're safer, which means we need to measure the health of critical barriers in jobs that we know we do every day that could have that potential to change a life. It sounds simple, but it does kind of hard. It's not actually easy to implement. But the knock-on benefit of that was it created real pull within the organization. And when you get people believing you're doing the right thing and it's not a pencil whipping exercise, oh, that's magic. Because then you're really transforming things. You have a chance of transforming things at the coalface in the field versus on some town hall. And that's what happened next. Mm. I asked the organization to create not just the lagging indicator, which we use for the KPI, but also credible leading indicators that would help us measure that health of those barriers. That's how we knew we were going to get the metric down, improve our bonuses, and know we were safer as an organization.
So the message from you, Eric, that you reiterated in several different ways, included then this drive for a leading indicator that's going to help with the KPI, which in this case, which is the piece that Ron is passionate about, and I understand his passion, is that the thing that we should be paying attention to and the thing that you wanted your operations teams to know the answer to is what work do we have that has high potential for catastrophic failure, right? Something life-altering. What are we doing that has the potential for that? What are the barriers that are in place on the mitigative side, preventive, I'm sure as well, but the mitigative side to know that when we do inevitably have something imperfect occurring, that we have some amount of control over the consequence, right? So if people are familiar with bow tie, right, the right hand side of the bow tie, what are they? What is the health of them? Not just do we have them, but do they work? Do they make sense to people? Are people using them? Are they getting in the way of work? And is it enough? Is that enough for us to be actually able to control the consequence when something goes wrong? And then from making that the criteria of what good looks like proactively, right, on the leading metric side, Ron, that's when you had folks just knocking on your door, pushing down your door, saying, "Hey, I need to know.
Yeah.
Eric's going to ask me. I need to know the answer. Help us." Is that what it looked like for you?
Well, for all of us, right? The whole department. And so being invited into operations world, and because of some hop influence, the program was to go meet with those folks at the sharp end of the spear and ask them what are the activities that, you know, can change your life. And who knows better than them what those are? And then what are those critical things that have to be in place each and every day to make sure that we're protected? Was another part of that back and forth. And so the output was a revision to our serious injury and fatality prevention program that the workers could see their fingerprints in. They were instrumental and probably understood the importance of them much more than they did before. It emphasized, you know, failing safe as being the, you know, countermeasures that were protective when people made mistakes. And I think what we learned is that it created an appetite within the organization from top to bottom towards moving up the hierarchy of controls. I mean, the hierarchy of controls, that concept is not new. Mm-mm. But with this shift in thinking, with this view of creating reliability, like the appetite and willingness towards the hierarchy, moving up the hierarchy, people were ready, willing, and couldn't wait to get there. And it was interesting what we saw in our accident investigations that it sort of began to prove to us that the needle had in fact moved, because we started seeing corrective actions being proposed, you know, on events that we had seen 10 years prior, where there'd be a laundry list of 15 new administrative controls that they're going to try or reinforce, where, you know, in that current state, we were seeing engineering solutions, you know, that created reliability so that when people, for example, wanted to drive their wireline truck off location with the derrick in the air, as an example, I don't know why that comes to mind, you know, and hit overhead power lines, you know, the organization was able to find very inexpensive solutions to ensure that when that mistake happens, we don't contact 12,500 volt electrical lines, as an example.
A great example. Yeah. Which is like the dream, right? And as somebody in a safety leadership position, of seeing an investigation where that is proposed as a solution set, or I mean, put in as a solution set, versus historically what we've always seen, which is, you know, retrain the person on always double checking, do not one donut around the truck, but two donuts, one counterclockwise, one clockwise, put 4 to 7 cones around the outside of the vehicle. So then you have to pick up 4 to 7 cones around the other way. Have somebody secondary check that you picked up your, I don't know, just, but all of those things, right, were the solution sets historically. And then suddenly this concept that is, as you said, not a new concept of hierarchy of controls, which before just kind of felt like an after check of like, oh, you know, which of these categories did it fall into? Administrative, administrative, administrative. Now suddenly feels like, oh, administrative doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel as though that's the right thing to do, because we also accept all of these other aspects that you've talked about over and over again of this, of the it will happen, right? It's at some point someone is going to try to drive away because of a million factors that we can't predict with the derrick in the air. Now what? And then the now what is the important part. And that's amazing, right? We've already accepted the loss of control, right? We've accepted the middle of that bow tie will happen. And then that gives us an opportunity for another way of looking at the same problem. Yeah.
Very true.
Let me add something to that if I can. I think that the unintended consequence of this that I didn't expect and that actually occurred relates to complexity. So as leaders, we are always trying to drive complexity out of the system because that drives cost. It drives waste of all kinds, right? And what Ron just mentioned about this focus on the health of barriers driving a focus on engineering controls instead of paperwork and administrative stuff, that has the unintended consequence of driving the complexity of adding ever more checks and steps that really don't make you safer out of the system. So it actually makes the business more efficient as well as safer in the most critical ways by driving this change. Yeah. And I thought that was an unintended consequence, but really made me happy as a leader who cares about efficiency and focus that we're simplifying things as a consequence of this versus adding ever more requirements and complexity.
Which, Eric, I think is a really helpful way to bring up that the fact that the change that you made reduced the paperwork complexity is a helpful way of looking at it, because oftentimes in this space, people will go after the paperwork complexity itself as the problem. Whereas what you're saying is when you shifted the focus to what we actually want to be happening, a natural byproduct of that was the reduction of this paperwork complexity, as opposed to positioning that itself as the problem, meaning the paperwork is the problem or the administrative controls is the problem, which I think in the view of many people who have tried to go after the problem, it is difficult to attack it directly because it's hard to know what to replace it with. Whereas if we're actively talking about what good looks like, that becomes the replacement. And then the natural byproduct is the reduction of all of the pieces that, you know, when we can step back and we do have another option, we start to say very clearly to ourselves and others, we can look each other in the eye and say, I'm not sure that that really ever had an impact on safety. When we don't have anything to replace it with, that is a terrifying thing to admit out loud. And you will see people argue until they're blue in the face that it does have an impact, because it is almost impossible to admit that it doesn't if you don't have anything to replace it with. So the fact that you saw it in the reverse of this is what we're going to focus on, and the natural byproduct is the reduction of this administrative burden. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, the logic train is that we want to have healthy barriers so that incidents don't escalate into life-changing. Barriers can best be strengthened by engineering controls, hierarchy. Therefore, let's spend our time and energy on those controls. Like it's, you know, and therefore the absence of the complexity on the administrative side. Whereas in previous investigations I've seen, it's let's prevent this from happening again. And it really comes down to, we don't have enough ways to tell workers how to do their job, which workers resent, safety people resent, and it just adds cost and complexity. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to belabor this point too much, but it really drives the right behaviors in the organization as a business leader and as a safety leader.
Yeah. Thank you for that. The piece that I'm wondering whether people would be interested in, actually, I can picture two pieces. One is, what was happening to continuously reinforce that direction? What I mean by that is, you know, Eric, if we have, obviously we have a KPI, right? So that KPI is going to reinforce the direction, but that KPI is specific then to when something has already gone wrong. And yet we have got leading indicators that you're looking at. Are you looking at that as how many times are we reviewing these things? Like, what does that leading indicator then look like? And then, Ron, what did that actually translate into how it was executed in the field? You started to describe it to us, and I have a bit of a mental picture of, you know, it's not what I would have historically done, where Andrea 1.0 would have sat in my office and written up a bunch of stuff for Eric that was like, this is the activities we're doing and here's the barriers. I mean, I remember distinctly actually doing that from my desk, not out in the field in my own organization, of here's what we have in place. And then that was perfectly acceptable in my world. So how do you get from it being a tabletop exercise, pencil whip of the barriers in place, to something that is real, like isn't just another paperwork administrative activity that is trying to point to something that isn't administrative? Like, how does that not just become an administrative activity itself?
I can take a good shot at this one. So as we talked about, we had this interaction with the folks that are at the sharp end of the spear. We felt like we learned a lot from that exercise. It informed what we called our critical protection standards. We later renamed them our lifeguards. And what those were a set of, I'll say processes, programs, that were very much aligned with the high consequence activities that the workers had identified. And within them included a set of controls, critical barriers. And then we revised our assurance program so that we could, and we had a lot of touch points so we could measure the health of those barriers from a leading indicator perspective. So now that we had a good view of the health of our critical barriers that were associated with our high consequence activities, we began a process of trying to learn and understand. For example, one of the critical barriers that we were struggling with was around crane use and the exclusion zone associated with crane use. And this was interesting because I was interested to understand why crane operators couldn't comply with our exclusion zone expectation. Yep. Because our assurance data says that we're deficient. And what we learned was very informative, you know, that our assurance and expectation around exclusion zones were causing them to make them much bigger than they really needed to be. And as a result, more people were required to be inside the exclusion zone than our auditors believed were necessary. And so they had feedback for us. They gave us a recommendation. Hey, when we're only lifting, you know, 200 pounds with a 30-ton crane, you know, we probably don't need an exclusion zone that accounts for the failure of the entire crane. We probably only need an exclusion zone the size, you know, that accounts for the failure of maybe the boom and the load. And so their feedback caused us to go back to our, you know, to the black line and the blue line and adjust the way that we imagine work occurring. So it really wasn't, it turned out to be a deficiency within crane operators. It was more an opportunity for us to learn from workers and adjust the expectation to match the level of risk. Ultimately, we want, as risk goes up, we want controls to go up. And in this case, controls were way high when the risk was way low, and that's what needed adjustment. Mm-hmm. So what we learned is that by asking workers, you know, what's creating safety at the job site, they know, and they'll tell us what's helping them, and they'll tell us what's not. And then that gave us an opportunity to adjust the expectation. We now have a much better measure, assurance measure, associated with that high consequence activity than ever before. It saved them time. It saved us money. It reduced a lot of anxiety and tension between our contractors and ourselves as well.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ron. So I'm getting the mental picture of how we get from a board conversation, a metric change, a communication to then what it actually looks like in the field. And I think we'll pause our conversation here, but the thing that I am really curious about that I feel like, at least in my mind, is that kind of the missing puzzle piece of how this all happened for you all is, Eric, when you talked about this transformation and the elements needed to provide the structure and the ability for the transformation, one of them was the idea of the talent and skill, like the underlying skill set needed to execute the things that you're asking for. And so Ron's describing a reality of a way to execute something that for most organizations, I don't know would be the natural first way to do it. Meaning if my CEO is asking me to know my barrier health, my first thought process without having a different level of skill provided to me or taught to me is going to be that this is a tabletop exercise for me to assure the leadership team that we have everything in place. And it's going to stay tabletop. And then the audit is going to happen. And they're going to audit to, for example, an exclusion zone. And then when we find that the exclusion zone isn't being followed, I'm going to go back to my original solution sets of how to strengthen that by telling workers that they need to do it better. And I'm going to do it slower and louder because that's the original thought process I already had. So something else had to have changed in order for that not to be the response. Meaning when we find a deficiency in a barrier, if we go back to the way that we were solving problems as, Andy 1.0, Eric 1.0, Ron 1.0, we're going to try to solve them the same way, which is to say the same thing slower and louder through a bunch of different communication efforts. And then when we put on our audit hat and go out into the field, magically we find in the moment that we're out in the field that the exclusion zone is people are honoring it. But as soon as we walk away, people go back to doing what they were doing before. And yet what you're describing is not that reality. You're describing that you find a deficiency in a barrier. You find that the health of what we think is happening isn't aligned with what we want to be happening. And you go out instead to the field and you have a real conversation with folks about what's happening. What does it look like? What is the day to day? Does this rule even make sense? And what I'm curious about is how does that happen organizationally? Like, where's that piece of the puzzle? And maybe you can describe that to us in the next episode.
What a cliffhanger. All right. So we'll do. Thanks for listening. We'll do this again.
Well, that's it.
Yep. Another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website www.hoppodcast.com.
That's HOPPODCAST.com.
It's still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.